All right. Good morning, Professor Yip. Thank you very much for joining us. As we were just discussing, the theme of this series of interviews is the ideas of replica symmetry breaking in spin glasses and beyond. But before we get to that, I have a few questions on background to try to situate your contributions to this. And first, can you tell us a few things about your youth and how you became interested in engineering in particular?
Yes. Good morning, Patrick. My pleasure. I was born in China. I grew up in Shanghai. At the age of 14, I was able to immigrate to the US with my parents and two brothers. This was a tumultuous time at the this is 1949, when the country was changing hands from the Nationalist to the Communist Party. And the whole family was able to get out. And that is really one of the amazing, fortunate incidents in my family, in my life, in fact. So we arrived in the US. I was 14 and in San Francisco. So, of course, my education was interrupted for about 1949, when there was all this fighting and the family was trying to leave. I was not in school because school was shut down. So anyway, I got through high school in the US and went off to college. This was about 1953. And for reasons I don't think it's necessary to go into, I chose to go to the University of Michigan. So I spent 10 years at Ann Arbor, and I got all my degrees there and started out in mechanical engineering. And by the time I was ready to graduate, nuclear engineering came on the horizon. It was a nuclear program. Eisenhower was promoting the plowshare. So nuclear power became a sort of a commercial reality. So there was a lot of interest in nuclear. At the same time, it was the Sputnik era and men on the moon, with competition with Russia. So there was a lot of new science and technology in the academia. So at that point, I thought I would be interested in nuclear engineering. The nuclear at the time was a graduate program. So I had to get an undergraduate degree, which I got in mechanical engineering. So I could say I would start out as a mechanical engineer, became a nuclear engineer, and that's when I got my degree at Ann Arbor, Michigan. I stay on one more year, so I made it 10 years at Ann Arbor. And that's because I had a favorite advisor who was a big influence in my professional career and personal career as well. He was a good role model for me. And so he and I stay on one more year, postdoctoral year, to help him write a book. The book is, if you don't mind my telling, it's called The Foundations of Neutron Transport Theory. Now, for someone who just finishes his PhD, it's pretty cheeky to say that you're not in a position to write a book on the foundations of any theory. And this turned out to be a second quantization derivation of the neutron transport equation. And so that's my how I got into kinetic theory and the Boltzmann equation. Well, my thesis was in neutron scattering in liquids. In particular, the liquid was water. That's because in most of the nuclear reactors being built in those days were water moderated, water cooled. So water became not only always interesting as a substance for science, but it became very important material for technology. Not only light water, but also heavy water, as you know, for reasons of neutron absorption. Anyway, so my start was mostly nuclear. Now I like to sort of move myself to the next stage, where I continue my interest in kinetic theory and transport theory. In the old days, traditional transport theory, like the Boltzmann equation, was well known to be only valid at low density, rarefied gas dynamics. for example, people in aerospace and fluid flow. But there was always a challenge for the folks who do kinetic theory and transport theory of fluids to go to high density. So the Boltzmann equation was well known to be a sort of a good starting equation at low density, but the effort to try to extend the equation to high density is where I became interested in liquid state depth dynamics. So that got me to the end of my stay in Ann Arbor. Then I went off to Cornell for 2 years as a research associate in applied physics with Mark Nelkin. Mark Nelkin was a very well-known person in nuclear reactor physics. He worked at the NOES Atomic Power Lab, and then he moved to academia, became a professor at Cornell. Nelkin was a student of Hans Bethe, and so he was a child prodigy and did very well in physics and went into nuclear reactor physics. So from his influence, I got more interested into the Cornell faculty and their discussions. People like David Merman, people like Ben Whittem in chemistry. So basically, I was able to sort of participate and listen and learn from people in theoretical physics and theoretical chemistry.
Did you go to Cornell you went to work with Nelkin, but was your objective to learn more about the kinetic theory of gases and kinetic theory in general? Or
at the time, going to Cornell was my next step in my career. It was a postdoc. It was a research associate appointment for two years. Mm-hmm. And I was willing to study whatever he thought would be interesting.
Okay, so it was to work with Nelkin mostly, rather, right, exactly. Okay, than the topic.
Right, and from his standpoint, Nelkin was interested to see how much of his background in neutron transport could be applied to more general problems in applied physics. So you can see that with the background in neutron transport, it was not a big step for me to cross over to talk about neutral particle transport. Okay, so because neutron has zone characteristics, which I don't have to worry about if I were doing liquid state fluid dynamics and so on. So anyway, that got me into the awareness of the fact that there's a need to extend these very well-known equations, the transport equation, the Boltzmann equation, into higher densities. And then we started to think about, you know, what is the bottleneck? It turned out the bottleneck is in the collisional part. So if you look at the transport equation, it has a sort of a streaming part, and then has a collisional part. Basically, these control the rate of change of the distribution function. So the streaming part is like if you have just free flight, then you have particles streaming in vacuum if it's low density. But if it's high density, if you are in a liquid, then you get into things like static structure factor, like equilibrium correlation functions of the fluid. So those things could be measured by neutron scattering, and they used to do X-ray neutron scattering. So there was more and more physical properties involved when one tries to go to higher and higher density. Now, by higher density at the time, we were only thinking about the liquid density at the triple point. That's already very high density, because if you start out with the rarefied gas dynamics, you are maybe talking about maybe one atmosphere, maybe, you know, at most a few atmospheres. When by the time you get to critical point, critical density, it's already, you know, quite high densities. Things are already non-trivial, because you no longer have particles streaming, you know, have particles colliding and so on. And when you try to go to triple point density, where now you're at much higher density than Boltzmann equation allows you to think, so you have to really do something much more drastic to the Boltzmann equation. Well, it turns out in kinetic theory, there is a very well-known approximation introduced by David Anscott. Anscott was given credit for saying that in order to extend the Boltzmann equation from low density to intermediate density, we can now introduce something like a mean field. Okay, that the mean field is the background, that is, when you have a particle moving in a liquid, it's aware of the fact that there are other particles nearby. So they could form a cage, they could do something, they would affect your trajectories. So it was easy to, introduce a mean field term into the transport equation and get significant benefit from the fact that you're now talking about higher density systems. But at that time, the mean field was only sort of like a structural enhancement. You're aware of your, I'm trying to build some physical intuition here in terms of later on, what when we start talking about, what is interesting about Mohr coupling theory, in some sense, why is Mohr coupling theory correct, intuitively realistic? I think this background may be useful. Namely, from the kinetic theory, transport theory point of view, it was already very well appreciated how to go to the next step, which is the mean field correction. It's like, also true for the Vlasov equation for plasmas. So the part that people are also starting to become aware at the time when I was at Cornell is that people also became aware of the fact, the collisional part. You see, if you look carefully into the Boltzmann equation, the kind of dynamics it describes is two particle uncorrelated dynamics. By that, I mean you have an ensemble of particles. You pick particle one and two out of this ensemble. You allow them to collide. So before the collision, you have particle one and two. After the collision, you have particle three and four, and they both go off into the back into the to the ensemble. And so the next collision then are totally uncorrelated. Boltzmann equation is able to treat binary collisions, but they're uncorrelated binary collisions. So the key word then becomes, what about the correlated binary collisions? Well, you can easily imagine if you have a dense liquid, a particle is really trapped by its nearest neighbors. It's not able to move away very far until you have had several collisions. Okay, so there's this caging effect, this reflection. So if you look at the velocity autocorrelation function, the velocity correlation function has to become negative. If you're high enough density, it's not just exponential decay or parallel decay, or has a long time tail. Even if it has a long time tail, it usually doesn't go negative. But when you go into high enough density, that means you provide enough caging, enough near neighbors, then the velocity correlation function can actually oscillate, become negative. That's the first indication you have backscattering of sufficient high probability that the particle is beginning to be trapped. But what people didn't understand was that how did the trap, the molecular cage evolve as a function of time? Because there's another time scale involved, which has to do with molecular dynamics, the actual dynamics of two particle collisions or two or three particle collisions. So the chemistry and the physics community began to look at three body collisions and four body collisions, very, very challenging, mathematically daunting analysis. And to some of us who are not mathematicians, it's practically get out of hand. The mathematics are so messy. So at that point, then people have to do resummation, right? Okay, so then you can say, so in that case, then you have other approximations of more recent origin coming in. But that was the time when people begin to realize that the transport equation, the kinetic theory of fluids was a good fertile ground for people to ask questions more and more about how do these collisions occur, how do they affect the distribution of the system. Okay, so
So
now
these
at
were
the
all conversations you were having during your time at Cornell already, or you're anticipating a bit what?
I'm including a larger community now because at the end of this this kind of discussion is what is really the dynamics of liquid state. That everybody knows if it's gas state, you can do the Boltzmann equation, you can have infrequent collisions. In solid state, you have fermions. So, but what happens when you go from the liquid to the solid or solid to liquid, either way? Okay, you can see that for communities who are interested in understanding melting, or for the community who is interested in crystallization, or if you try to crystallize something very rapidly, quenches it and it becomes glassy. So you can see that that's the when you start thinking about what's the difference between these different states of matter, particularly with regard to the glassy state, there are two aspects that become quite distinct. One is the structural aspect, and people could do neutron X-ray measurements of crystal. They do a crystallography, and they can determine the details of the crystal structure and call it topology, if you like, morphology. And then there's also dynamics. People understand that, in diffusion, people can measure diffusion coefficients in liquids or in gases. So there, you can now think about different properties of the material as to how they change with regard to density and with regard to temperature. And later on, all we want to do, we don't care that much about density for the time being, because when you talk about the glassy state, the so-called glass transition, it's really basically due to temperature. It's like thermal quenching.
So I think we'll get to glasses eventually, but I'd like to, right, to take you back on your own trajectory for now. Right.
Yeah.
So after your time at Cornell, you didn't work much on kinetic theory up until your collaboration with Jean Mazenko in the early to mid 70s. Can you tell us a bit? And that's when you there was this idea in a sense of resummation or this fully renormalized kinetic theory. Can you describe how this collaboration came about and what led to pursue this work?
Yeah, well, it was my good fortune that Jean Mazenko was finishing his thesis at MIT, and he decided he needed to get a postdoctoral position with somebody. So he was sort of pacing, this is what he told me, he was outside my office trying to figure out how to introduce himself to me. Unbeknownst to me, I was looking for someone who could sort of work with me in trying to understand these high-density correlated collisions. So it became a perfect match for us. And he and I, started working together as soon as he finished his PhD. And at about the same time, I should also mention, I owe a great debt to Paul Martin at Harvard. And so, not to make the story too long, I was at Cornell for 2 years. And my second year there, I got a call from MIT, nuclear engineering department, whose department head at the time remember meeting me when I was a student at Ann Arbor, Michigan. So he said, we have a position faculty opening here. Would you be interested? I said, yeah, of course. So I went over and did an interview, and they offered me a job right away. So I had a position at MIT. While I was still at Cornell, I went to a Gordon conference, and I ran into Paul Martin. We happened to be shaving together next to each other. At that time, I was reading this paper about Katnoff and Martin, which just came out in Annals of Physics, about generalized hydrodynamics, mean fields and what have you, propagators and self-energy. So Martin was looking at these kind of questions of liquid state dynamics from the standpoint of field theory. Now, the reason I mentioned Paul Martin is that when I talked to him at the Gordon conference, I told him, I'm a young guy, I'm just going to start my career at MIT. He hit it off pretty well, and he said, why don't you just come up, we have some lunch once in a while. So for the next 3 years, when I was starting my career, I was able to go and have lunch maybe once every 1 or 2 months with Paul Martin. And we chatted over lunch, and we decided to see if there's some common interest. So after 3 years or so, we ended up writing 3 papers together. So I got to learn something from Paul, a lot from Paul. And so he was a great great mentor for me. And so that was that. Now, going back to my work, Mazenko, since Mazenko was working with me and he didn't mind also talking to Paul Martin, so also Gene had the Martin's association. And Martin apparently was, at the time, he was interested in seeing how he could apply his methods with Schwinger, the Martin Schwinger formalism, to other problems, including fluids, liquid dynamics, and plasmas, and also turbulence. So Martin had a very broad interest. So, all these problems seem to have the same kind of challenge, namely in terms of there are many body dynamical systems, chaotic systems, instabilities, and phase trend, what have you. So that was a good time, and both Gene and I were heavily influenced by what we could learn from Paul Martin and people who associated with Paul. And then Gene later on ended up, he went off from Cambridge to, he got a position in Chicago. And also there he started doing things with Sid Nagel and so on. So that's how these things go. Now, my own involvement was that I actually was not doing, after Gene left, I can speak more about what Gene and I have done, but basically, that was Gene's contribution to work on the renormalized kinetic theory. So kinetic theory at the time was just Boltzmann equation and Scott modification. So Gene was going to start this whole new thing he called renormalization kinetic theory. And this was maybe around the same time when Ken Wilson, who was at Cornell, when I first went there, I actually, went to sit in his class. He was talking about these things. And then when I got to MIT, Ken Wilson came out to Harvard to give talks about renormalization group. This was right before he won the prize. So renormalization became a sort of a buzzword, not only for for what the thing really stands for, but also other fields started to realize that they could benefit from renormalization.
I see. In 1979, you wrote a review of that approach in which you highlighted the connection between normalized kinetic theory and mode coupling theory, in that both approaches, and I quote, in fact, should be viewed as basically belonging to the same theoretical description of fluids. You were there predict you predicted that the resulting description can claim to be valid for fluids at all densities. And interestingly, in that review, you don't mention viscous fluids or glasses at all. Was the topic not of interest to you at that point already, or did you not see a plausible way of connecting these dynamical approaches to the glass problem yet?
It's the latter. So, at that time, we had some urgent issues that we want to deal with, but I was not. I was sort of learning as I went along. So I was not aware of the glass transition problem, which later on became so dominating. So at the in 79, in fact, that's a pretty critical year for me because I took a sabbatical, I think 1980, to Munich. And my purpose to go to Munich was I wanted to work with Wolfgang Dietze. Because back in 79, already I became aware of what Goetze was doing. Goetze had at least one student by the name of Manfred Lucca, who's still around. And I think he was one of the earlier students of Wolfgang. And they started publishing, and there was another young man by the name of Jürgen Bosse, Bosse, and both Lucke and Bosse were working with Goetze, and they were publishing regularly papers on what we can now call the mode coupling theory approach of liquids. And they were getting amazing results. Not many people really understood what was the mode coupling theory, And in fact, I sort of thinking back, I think Goetz appreciated that. So see, he did not, just call it world-cupping theory right away. If you look at his papers, he calls them dynamical theory. Indeed, it's a dynamical theory. But later on, other people talk about, it is not a real dynamical theory because it has some uncontrolled approximations. So people who want to criticize can say something. But basically, to me, at that time, from the kinetic theory community, we were having a hard time trying to explain things, not so much from the experiment. Later on, the experiment became very important, but things that Bernie Alter was telling us, Anish Raman was telling us. Because now this is the third leg of what we're talking about, not just theory or the theorists, but also experimentalists who are now doing new experiments, neutron scattering in liquids. And Anish Raman was publishing his seminal paper on molecular dynamics for continuous potentials. And also Bernie Alder and Wainwright were in Lawrence Livermore publishing their hard sphere simulations. Very important questions being asked about, the decay of the velocity autocorrelation function. Why is it not exponential? Why is it t to the minus d over 2? D is the dimension. So all these things came on. And when I was asked to write this annual review, I basically, I was no expert. I was trying to see intuitively what makes sense. It seemed to me we're all dealing with the same beast. The beast is how do you gain control of the dynamical description, which includes the mean field. I mean, the self-consistency is absolutely important. So, because if you don't, these diagrammatic approaches get out of hand, the resummation get out of hand. So at some point, you have to. I guess I'm getting ahead of myself again, but basically, I had a hunch by just talking to people like Martin and Jim Mazanko. I had a hunch that these are the same problem. And they should be treated in the same way. And in fact, toward the end of this interview, I guess we're already half an hour into it, I'd like to make a statement about what I think should be done. Namely, I think there are a lot of things that
We'll
could
get
be.
to that if you allow us, and then
Okay.
because you said so you went on sabbatical, which I think is in 79 or 80 to Munich. But did you know Professor Goetz ahead of time, or it was only through papers? And you, so.
It's again, it's a very fortunate personal circumstance. I knew of his work, of course, and I don't know if he knew me, but when I what the 79 was my second sabbatical. But my first sabbatical that I took, I had a Guggenheim fellowship, and I took it with Paul Martin at Harvard. So that was my first. I went to MIT 65. So by the time 1980 came around, that was my second sabbatical,
Okay.
and I wanted to, if I could have my choice, I wanted to go spend, at least part of it in Munich with Goetze, because I want to learn more about this mode coupling theory approach, because I really felt it has great potentials for many many things. So I somehow someone a common acquaintance said, he was going to see Goetz the next week. I said, he said, "Do you have a message?" I said, "Yeah, I wouldn't mind coming to Munich to spend a sabbatical." So it turned out Wolfgang and Kurt Binder, who's another person that I wanted to spend some time with, together they jointly nominated me for the Humboldt Prize for U.S. sciences. So that's how I got to spent half a year with Wolfgang, the first half, and the second half with Kurt Binder in Munich.
Okay. So, I mean, this visit, I mean, as you said, was to learn more about the mode coupling approach, but it led to a very important series of papers about the Lorentz gas, the random the of overlap what you call the Lorentz model of overlapping hard spheres, what we now call the random Lorentz gas in some circles. How did this first Did you know about this model ahead of time? Or
no.
And second, how did the work come about and
yeah.
the collaboration come about?
Right. My first meeting with Wolfgang in his office when I showed up and got settled was I met Eberhard Leuhäuser, who was a graduate student with Wolfgang at the time. So there was an immediate meeting of us three people, and Wolfgang simply said to me, you know, you and I can talk about what it is we want to do while you're here. And here's Eberhard. He's been working with me. He's about ready to finish. So I met Eberhard right there. And it seemed like everybody was in agreement that the three of us will work together. So that was not, it didn't take any effort. It was a very natural thing. Once I showed up, it turned out, you know, with some hindsight, Wolfgang and I got along pretty well, and Eberhard and I got along pretty well. And then at the end of my sabbatical, I went off to Jülich from Munich, and Wolfgang was happy to let Eberhard to come over once or twice, and we continued working. So my association with Eberhard was not interrupted after I left Wolfgang. And then even after my sabbatical with Humboldt, Humboldt was so pleased, so generous to send Eberhard as a postdoctoral fellowship to come spend a year, at least about a year, with me in Cambridge. So Eberhard and I continue working. Now we're getting close to the time when these two papers appear simultaneously, practically simultaneously.
But so, I'd like to talk about the random Lorentz gas first, if you don't mind.
Right, sure.
So, I mean, where did the idea from for that work come about? And what, I mean, what were you trying to show? Or what was the program, in a sense?
Right. So when I was, again, let me take you back ways back when I was at Cornell. So around 1960, between 1963 and 65, while I was at Cornell, I met Hans von Leuven, who was a visitor with Ben Widom in the chemistry department. So von Leuven and I started talking. It turns out from Hans von Leuven, I learned about these pretty well-known mathematical model, so-called the Lorentz model. In one dimension, particles always bond because eventually it's going to be reflected. But in 2 and 3D, it's not so obvious. So we had a background, and I don't remember now if Wolfgang had the same appreciation, but I had an appreciation from an association with Ben Leuven, whose work with Whalen we also quoted, was the precursor to our discussion with Wolfgang about, you know, what might be an interesting system. We were a little bit careful not to go straight into just a full blown liquid with Leonard Jones or, you know, continuous potential, not just hard spheres. We were rather careful to try to do first of all with hard spheres, and if hard sphere works, then we can add some corrections with attractive forces. And Weeks, Chan, and Anderson's modification were in the back of our mind. So anyway, we started to look for a model system that we can study. And it turned out to be very rich, because once Wolfgang got into it, you can see that the three papers we published with Wolfgang and Leuhäuser was that the first one was a sort of general setting down what the Lorentz model is, but we didn't even have to call it the Lorentz model. So I really think that was a well chosen title. It's just static random field, right? So the scatterers provide the keyword is the randomness. So if you want to talk about the correlation functions in a random medium, this is a nice model to start. Okay, so that was the first of the three papers. Once we got into the second paper, I think is called the second paper is called correlation function of the hard sphere Lorentz model, and then the third one is in the two-dimensional Lorentz model. We actually looked at the diffusion coefficient. We talk about localization. So It was a pretty meaty topic once we got into it. You know, we can first of all talk about the Lorentz model in general. Don't even call it Lorentz, you just call it the random static field. And then you can specialize the logo. Anyway, so that's how I learned about diffusion and localization. And
Okay.
it turned out for the glass transition, diffusion localization was part of the excitement.
So at about the same time, you had a collaboration with Bernie Elder on molecular simulations for determining neutron scattering function for hard spheres.
Right.
So hard spheres were there as well. But by any chance, did you at the time meet Marianne Mansai, the
Oh,
person who was writing the computer codes?
Yes, I got to know Marianne very well. I also got to know Ed Alley very well. Ed Alley was a grad student. He was also a staff member at Lawrence Livermore Lab. But Marianne was the backbone of Bernie Alder's research group. I mean, she does all the coding. She knows how to feed those monster computers that Livermore has access to, as you may appreciate. Livermore and Los Alamos have access to the state-of-the-art computers because their mission is to nuclear weapons research. So there were, if anybody has big computers, lots of computer time, these guys would have it. And at Los Alamos, Bill Woods was also doing these many-body problems like liquids and solids and so on, but he was doing Monte Carlo. So Alder and Wainwright were doing molecular dynamics. Well, hard spheres, they've always worked on hard spheres. That's Alder's mantra.
Yes.
Right. Okay. But so I, you know, I felt that if we're going to work on liquids and a lot of, in fact, the hard spheres, the best way to check out a theory for hard spheres is not with experiments, because there are very few, you have to do it. Few experiments you can claim to be true hard spheres. They're always corrections. Whereas with simulation, you can have a hard sphere anytime you like. So Bernie was also interested in development of the transport coefficients, how they behave at high densities, because that was what he was pushing. So I spent a couple of summers at Livermore, and I got to have the most important thing is I got to have access to Bernie Alder's attention and discussions with him, and also I got to have access to his data. So when I went to Munich and talked to Bleuheiser and Wolfgang, at that time there are two sources of computer simulation data, one from Netherlands. There was a student there, Bernard C. Bruhn. I never met him, but he apparently did a PhD thesis on the Lorentz model, and had some results on the velocity autocorrelation function, on diffusion coefficient as a function of density. So that was not as extensive as the Livermore, Alder, and Alley results. So those became the results we could use to test the Mohr-coupling calculations.
So was Marianne Mansai at all involved in these projects, or
she was always involved? I mean, you know, she is the one who actually did the calculations, but Bernie would make the decisions, as you might expect, and Ed Alley would sort of right shotgun on the thing and just make sure it all goes well. And if there, so Bernie was able to sort of stay back out of the details, but also he always made sure it was going in the right direction. But the other thing is that Marianne was always acknowledged and thanked in the acknowledgement, but she, as far as I know, she was seldom, if ever, one of the authors.
Yes,
but it's well known she's highly appreciated, and so you know, anybody who works with Bernie Alder would automatically get to know Marianne.
So getting back to your collaboration with Lothar, sir, I mean, after his time at MIT, He went back to Munich, and he published an article, a seminal article as well, on the dynamical model of the liquid glass transition. As you said, was closely in time with that of Goetze and collaborators. But in Leuthoff's article, he actually acknowledges conversations with you on this topic. So can you tell us a bit about your involvement in the genesis of that work?
Yeah, this may take a few minutes because as you may have heard, after I left Munich, I went to Jülich, and Leuthoff visited me while I was still in Germany. And then after I went back to MIT, Leuthoff came to MIT and stayed with me for a year. So during that time, we continued talking, and then we were sort of on the verge of saying, well, why don't we apply Mohr coupling theory to liquid, and so he and I were actually talking about these things that he eventually published. I think it's really a matter of historical circumstances that when he went back, when Leuthoff left MIT, go back to Munich. I had expected that he would share the results with Goetze, and then whether Goetze was interested or not, at least they communicated. Because when Leuthoff was in Cambridge, I inferred that Wolfgang also was visiting. He was visiting Alt Schulland in Göteborg. So, but both, let's say, both the professor and the student were continuing their collaboration. The collaboration, as they started on Lorentz gas when I was there, and then afterwards, Leuthoff came to MIT, and Wolfgang went to Göteborg and continued working with Ulf Benzelius and Alt Schulander, and then somehow they both arrive at the same result, which appear in these two papers in 1984. So let's just take a more detailed look at this. In 1984, Leuthoff's paper, according to FizzRev, was submitted on, I think it was March. There was a date that I had put down. Yeah. So
December
Leuthoff,
83.
yeah, was December 83, and Benzelius' paper was March 84.
Yes.
So it was, within like 3 months of each other. So, and I'm positive they both know what each other was up to, but the question I cannot answer to this date is that what is the reason that they decided not to publish together? I mean, you so at this point, I guess people, I was hoping, in fact, because for the purpose of this interview, I was hoping that we could actually get in touch with Leuthoff, because Wolfgang passed away, unfortunately, last year. So I was very sad to hear about that. So I meant to ask him, and then I think I saw him as late as 2000 when they celebrated his 60th birthday. He didn't want to talk about it. And Leuthoff, from what I heard, left the field. So, and whether or not other people know, to this day, I cannot find out. Who knows what happened? So it's left to history. It's left to anybody who wants to say anything. But I don't have the information. I have a guess, which I wouldn't mind sharing with you offline.
But you were never going to be involved in the paper with Eberhardt in any event.
Well,
Or was that also not clear?
well, it was not clear because the truth is that Eberhard and I had written a manuscript, which we already submitted to PRL. All right, this part is factual. I can talk about it. So when Eberhard left me, and I'm a little fuzzy on dates. I think he left me, right, sometime in 1983, because I have a, yeah. So I think Eberhard stayed at MIT was 1982, maybe end of 82, beginning of 83. So when he left me, we actually had a manuscript for PRL that we sort of drafted, and he was going to submit it after he got back. And then I heard from him that he is now in a situation he wants to submit on his own a paper to PRA, which got published. So that's why I say Eberhardt's paper in PRA was submitted in December 83.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. So now at that point, he told me, he said, Sid, because of circumstance, he did not want to explain or tell me. He said, I need to submit this paper first and let's see what happens with. So basically, he submitted the PRA. I don't remember the because of the PRL draft was only a draft form. We did circulate it to people like Mazenko and Shankar Das. So I couldn't find it because of, you know, my record keeping. I didn't even save a copy. So at this point, I don't even have my own copy. But basically, we got a reply from PRL. So the referee said, I have also just reviewed and accepted the paper by Lighthizer for PRA. Since these two contents are similar, there is no need for a PRL. So the PRL was just stopped.
Disappeared.
That, right.
So you mentioned sharing a draft with Mazenko, Gene Mazenko and Das on that theme. And actually shortly after, Professor Mazenko did publish a work on mold coupling theory as well. How involved or how much were you in contact or in discussion with him about these topics at the time?
Yeah, actually, you know, Gene and I were working together on renormalized kinetic theory and then talking to Paul Martin, and he went out to Chicago. We were on very good terms, and so I kept them informed of what we're doing. So that's why I just spoke to Shankar Das recently, and he said he may have a copy, but he may have lost the copy of the PRL draft. So both Gene and Shankar have seen this, and what they did is, you know, they also came up with because they were working on this sort of field theory approach to liquid state, the dynamic supercool liquids. So they actually immediately published, I should let them speak for themselves. They immediately published something that basically confirms the mold coupling theory results. But at the same time, they made a very critical finding, namely that there is no ergodic to non-ergodic transition. There is a cutoff. Okay. So, mm-hmm. And they pointed to the fact that the cutoff has to do with hopping. And the hopping was the one that Shogren, in his conversation with you, talked about that. Because if you look at the raw, what's called the original MCT, in the hands of the 1984 papers by both Lighthizer and Benzelius and Goodson and so on. So if you take that, it seemed to predict this non-ergodic transition, namely the density correlator does not decay in time. Right? Mm-hmm. So you can non-ergodic. Now, it turns out that there's a mechanism that particular formulation of mold coupling theory did not include, and that's what later on people call barrier hopping. So you have these couple modes which leads to this. So now, if I were to use my own language about, you know, what mold coupling really is doing for you, mold coupling theory is a marvelous theory for giving you nonlinear feedback effect. So I would now explain the Lorentz model. It's a demonstration that you have a theory called the mold coupling theory, which can treat is highly nonlinear feedback effect to such an extent that the diffusion can be blocked, you get localization. But localization is only in that theory. In reality, there's another mechanism which is not in the theory, and that's the hopping mechanism. I mean, from that standpoint, it was to be expected that Mazenko and Das found that there's a way out. And then I think later on, Goethe himself and Shogun continued to work to try to put back in this hopping mechanism. But the hopping mechanism was to be expected. And it was always, I would say it's always there. And how do I know? I know it from simulation.
So after the series of papers, you largely left the field of glasses, but I think you followed quite closely the developments of mode coupling theory. Is that correct? And if yes, how did you stay on track or stay involved?
I was always interested in you know, how far mode coupling theory could go, since I was friendly with all the participants, all the people working on it. So I always had an interest, but later on, so allow me to now say that being at MIT, I was aware of the fact that there are other related areas of research which I could get involved in, and that's actually to start looking at from the solid side, from the crystal side. All right, so if you look at what does liquid state dynamics look like? You could ask the question from the solid, when you know you have phonons, when you know you have deformations, what do things look like from the theoretical standpoint, and what do they look like from the simulation standpoint? Because around that time, I was sort of giving up, you know, my mathematical capabilities are rather restricted. So I could never match people like Lighthizer and Wolfgang Goethe. So you know, I say, well, I look for something else. At that time, it occurred to me that, you know, doing three-body, four-body collision is sort of not going to converge. The radius convergence is so, you know, not going to converge. So I better try to rely on the machines. So I thought maybe simulation could show us. My intention had been, you know, that this is my cop-out. I always say, let me learn what's going on first in simulation. I go back and redo the theory, put it into the theory. Okay, so it turned out it was not that way at all, because the simulation had its own knots and so forth. So once you get into simulation, there are always endless questions that you want to ask. So, but basically, I never actually got back to the theory that I thought I would get back to. And it was my luck that I have access to people like Bernie Alder, and later on I also did some work with people who do large scale simulations for nuclear non-proliferation systems. Well, that's a different story. But basically, I spend time now on solids. But here is something that I think I could say. But most, I don't hear it too often. The reason liquid is somewhat boring for people in the solid state community is that liquid, everything relaxes so quickly. If you perturb it, it just relaxes very, very quickly. That's why, you know, you can have vortices, you can have waves, you can have tsunami, and eventually the thing just heals it itself. Not so with solids, right? So. Mm-hmm. In solids, there is such a thing as the microstructure. So I finally realized that if you talk to a solid state person, liquid is not so interesting because it has no microstructure. There's no all the defects are quickly relaxed away. That's why liquids is so tolerant, right? That's why it's so resilient. So the good and the bad. Now, if you want to have interesting defects to study, after all, most properties of solids are interesting because they have defects, whether it's cracks, whether it's grain boundaries or bubbles, whatever. And this we can extend to Anderson localization. You have impurities. Okay, so then the question is that in the solid case, there are also lots of well-known challenges people have not been able to overcome from both theory, experiment, and simulation. And let me give you an example. So in the glass transition, everybody goes to the shear viscosity and following Austin Angel and say, okay, the shear viscosity, you measure as a function of temperature, you supercool your glass forming liquid. And you can measure 10 orders of magnitude in the viscosity. Okay, it goes from very, very low viscosity in the liquid phase until it starts to freeze and the viscosity starts to rise. And then if you look at the experimental data, there is a sort of a freezing point or a glass transition point where you think now the viscosity has increased by 3 orders of magnitude. 3 orders of magnitude is nothing when you have 16 orders of magnitude. So people in the glass transition have been looking at how the viscosity as a function of temperature can be explained. And this, now we go back to the glass transition problem. This is, not so much about theories about Lorentz gap, but if you talk about people like Austin Angel, people who really know about glasses, so they always go to things like the viscosity, or there's a thing called the shear thinning, right? If you take a slurry, if you take a colloidal system, then you can talk about how the viscosity of a colloidal system would behave. So the other things, so things become more interesting. Whereas in the liquid state, you only have temperature or density. That's okay. Now in the solid case, you have defects. So you can have one dimensional defects, like point defects, and you have two dimensional defects and also three dimensional defects. So not only do you have grain boundaries, you can have, so I started to find a whole arena of interesting topics people were trying to think about. And I was trying to do it from what the simulation can tell me as a physical insight. So the field is basically plasticity and also fracture mechanics. My favorite example, let's say if you're a liquid state person, you want to talk about what people in the solid state community are interested in. The thing that's closest to the viscosity is creep. People were working with solids. Creep is a big deal. In fact, what is creep? Creep is deformation under constant stress.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you could lean, if you're standing on an ocean cruise ship, you can lean on it. If you wait a year, that ship may even move because there's a weight on it. So now we get into rheology and so on. So I think rheology comes in, and of course, and I had to learn a lot of things from scratch. So it took me a while. Basically, I didn't get back to, I wouldn't say this if I didn't actually later on. So I got back to the interest in the glass transition problem and the glass viscosity. This was later, not around 2000, about 2005-ish, when I met someone from Owens Corning. John Morrow, in fact, he was their chief scientist for a while. He's now at Penn State. John Morrow is my go-to expert on glasses, because he had worked at this industrial company. He knows a lot about glasses. I met him at a meeting, and he asked me, he said, if you can do simulation, can you calculate viscosity? I said, yeah, we'll do green cool, we can calculate viscosity. But he said, can you calculate the viscosity of a glass? Well, I said, well, it's hard. And the reason it's hard is that when you get into a glass, the shear stress autocorrelation function, which gives you, whose time integral gives you the viscosity, doesn't converge because that stress correlation function has a very long tail. And you just cannot do the simulation long enough to get 16 orders of magnitude. Nobody can with the simulation. So that was a challenge. So back in 2005-ish, when Morrow and I met at a conference, I said, yeah, let me give it some thought. So I actually got a small grant from Owens Corning to see if we can calculate it. At that time, I had a very genius, clever postdoc by the name of Kushima. So Kushima joined my group, and there was another postdoc by the name of Si Lin, and a couple of my former students. So we all sat around talking about, can we actually calculate? So we learned a technique that it was proposed by Parinello, Leal and Parinello, about 2005. It's called metadynamics. So it's quite a, the idea is quite simple because in molecular dynamics, you move all the particles and you move them according to the forces acting on them by all the other particles. So the most time-consuming part of calculation is calculating the forces. Now, if you have the energy, but to calculate the forces, you have to take gradients, right? So, but now, if you can, what can you do with energy? Well, if you do Monte Carlo, you can move particles by energy. You don't need, all right? So in this case, you actually can now do, you can do sort of molecular simulation, but they're not Monte Carlo. You actually calculate the forces by relaxing the particles through energy. And there's a marvelous diagram that explains the idea of the metadynamics. And that is, if you assume a particle is trapped in some local configuration, you cannot get out from its cages from the neighbors, you give the particle some additional energy, small amount, you let it share it with its neighbors. And so basically, you can imagine you have a cave explorer who's trapped in the bottom of a cave and cannot get back up. So you lower the rope, and the rope gives the man per person a little bit leverage so he can climb certain distance, but still not quite far enough to get up. So eventually, you give in small amount the activation energy, and you let it spread around locally. And that's up to you how you spread it. You can define the range, so there's a length you can introduce. So basically, you allow the system to sort of self-activate and climb out of this hole, and therefore escape from the cage. Okay. Now we adapted this technique from Parinello and Leal, and we gave it a name called ABC. ABC stands for Autonomous Basin Climbing Method. And what this postdoc Kushima did, and we eventually published it, is a method that allows you to sample very, very rough terrain in the potential energy landscape. And it turns out that that's the problem is with, if you believe people are still Frank Stillinger and Tom Weber, so basically you can think of glasses in terms of their energy, potential energy landscape. I think that's actually a very good way to think about that. So the so-called fragile glass versus the strong glass, the oxides, but the fragile glass, the ones that show non-arranged behavior. The difference between them is the difference in the profile of the potential energy landscape. The fragile glass is much rougher, so you have to go through much higher mountains, up and down, up and down. And that's what gives this highly non-arranged behavior. Whereas with the oxides, the smooth glass, you can begin understand they have a much smoother potential energy scale. Anyway, we use that method to actually demonstrate this is actually correct. So there's a series of papers that now have shown us. I don't know how much other people are
So,
interested,
getting back to MCT, just before we conclude, so you organized a special issue in 1995 about MCT, sort of 10 years in. Can you tell us a bit how that because as you were just saying, you had left the field at a point working on solids and simulations. But how did that idea come about, and how did you get to be in
Yeah.
charge?
Well, again, the serendipity. The around 1995, I think at that time, I was offered, this journal called Transport Theory and Statistical Physics. has a very broad scope. And I happen to know one of the original founding editors, Paul Zweifel. And then Zweifel mentioned to me that, you know, they're looking for new topics to make a theme special issue. So at that time, it felt to me that I wanted to see if we could have a 10-year perspective, 10-year retrospective on, all right, so this is 1995, there was 1984. I never forgot that 1984, there's these two remarkable papers. I want to call attention to that. So if you read the preface, that's actually my motivation. I said, well, two remarkable papers came out the same. I didn't want to get into to why there are two different papers rather than the same paper, but I think it's now time to have a look. And that's why I picked the title of the theme issue. I call it the special issue devoted to relaxation kinetics and supercooled liquids dash mole cupping theory and experimental tests. I felt that mole cupping theory has been known now for 10 years, and there have been quite a few experimental papers commenting on its validity and so on. I also felt a little bit unhappy about the fact that the theoretical community seemed to be much more skeptical than the experimentalists. And I think somebody mentioned this in one of your interviews already. Maybe it was well recognized, because the experimentalists had nothing they could use to analyze their data. So if you look at the mole cupping theory and from Goetze and from Leuthauser, it predicts a scaling behavior. It actually, you could use it to calculate relaxation curves as a function of time. So it has a number of predictive results which the experimentalists can use directly. And I think once they did that, they didn't really care whether it was 100% well justified or not. You can say, oh, well, you know, it's only a mean field theory, it's missing correlation. Well, maybe true, but still, it's the best theory around. So I think just by people voting with their feet, I think it's time to take a poll among the community. So I remember asking Wolfgang if you wouldn't mind writing a sort of a lead paper giving a 10-year look at this mole cupping theory, and he agreed. I think he wrote this with Sjogren, and then I asked a number of other people like Mazenko, and so on, and anyway. So I thought, you know, maybe it's not my business because I don't have that much to contribute, but I thought it was time to ask the community to stand up and put into words on paper what's good or what's still missing. And even if it's missing, I don't think that's the end of the world, because that's really room for more work. So I wanted to leave with the impression that, you know, my personal vote is that I'm positive about it. I think, you know, it's good to have discussions, and exactly like what you're doing now. You know, you make it easy for people to give comments and to be transparent, to be frank. And then, but I think the overall benefit is for the community, because there are now more things, more questions to look into for the younger folks.
So during your time at MIT or elsewhere, did you ever teach about the multi-coupling theory of glasses? And if yes, no. Can you detail?
Well, you know, I learned a lot about mole cupping theory of glasses by sort of transferring, by analogy, by transferring insights. But no, because, you know, being in the nuclear engineering department, my day job is to teach. I used to teach a course in transport theory, but mole cupping theory was transport theory was about neutrons and reactor physics. But I did teach a fundamental course in nuclear physics. Okay, so So even in nuclear physics, I could see some advantage. And so that's one thing I can say. But the other thing I could say is that if you're a chemist, I think you're a professor of chemistry too, right? So you know about chemical reactions. Okay, so when you have a reacting system, you always have sort of a criticality issue. When does the reaction go and not go, right? When do you reach criticality? So in nuclear physics, in nuclear reactor physics, criticality is a big deal. Because if you're subcritical, you don't have a bomb, you don't have a power station working. So the whole thing about understanding nuclear reactors is to understand criticality. Criticality, the calculation, is fundamental to everything that we do. So in that sense, when something goes, so the phase transition of a system is when it becomes critical, right? Subcritical, super. So that sort of mindset is transferable from the Mohr company theory. So I from time to time I find that that's useful. And of course, most of my students, they're quite open-minded. So if I would, I couldn't get them to pay a lot of attention to Mohr coupling theory unless it's part of their thesis. So it was not easy, and it was not a full-time job. And even now, I think there are useful parallels that one can glean from one field to another. But on the other hand, I see nothing wrong in having my the students who work with me being more conversant and more knowledgeable about the glass transition. Later on, my research in materials, solids, was getting close because, as I said before, in materials, you also are interested in things like strength, deformation, and fracture. To me, fracture could be a phase transition, right? It doesn't have to be failure. And deformation, it's all about mechanisms. It's about, so Anderson localization, I could twist it around and make it a problem in transport of interest to people in solid state. Of course, it is something that came out of semiconductors. So anyway, I think there are possibilities, but one has to work hard at them.
Is there anything else you would like to share with us about that era that we may have missed or overlooked?
Yeah. Okay. So I guess there are two things, and I'll try to get that in pretty quickly. There was a 60th anniversary celebration of Goetze's birthday in Munich. And Sankar Das just reminded me to say that Kiyoshi Kawasaki actually made a remark that I think I would like to just read now. This remark was in his contribution to the Festschrift. Despite various criticisms raised against the MCT of supercooled liquids and glass transitions, we feel that the position of the MCT pioneered by Goetze and others is now firmly established in history as a classic, in the same sense that the mean field theories due to van der Waals and Weiss are the classics in the history of the phase transitions study. I read that because I share the same sentiments as Kiyoshi. It's not perfect, there are defects, but they're actually good because we can then work on them some more for the generations to come. The other thing that I thought I could close with is to say that I am interested in trying to participate in thinking about the future, what we can do to encourage the young people who follow our footsteps, and by reading our history. So maybe I just read this because it's quicker. So I would say the conceptual framework underlying MCT was not developed only to provide an explanation of the glass transition phenomena. Rather, the predictions of the ideal glass transition is an outcome of MCT. In other words, MCT is not a first principle theory without ansatz. Such theories does not presently exist and is not likely to emerge from any of the competing theoretical formulations in the literature. As an example, there is much current interest in the rheological behavior of glassy systems known as dynamical heterogeneities. And yet, dynamical heterogeneities remained a set of properties of space-time correlation functions for which a unifying description more rigorous or better justify the MCT or its extension. By the way, the MCT extension is sometimes called MCT ITT for integrated through transient. And that's an extension of MCT to systems that are out of equilibrium. Okay. And there are many others who are better qualified to talk about that. In my opinion, the so-called glass transition is a complex physical phenomenon which constitutes an open grand challenge for the broad community of soft matter science and technology, like a research frontier in theory, experiment, and simulation for generations of physical, mathematical, and computer scientists to come.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In closing, do you have any... You've mentioned a bit this, but just to be clear, do you still have notes, papers, or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
Yeah, well, you know, as we're speaking, I'm finishing up the checking the manuscript for the MIT Press, a small book that I've been trying to write for the last 2-3 years. In fact, much of the sentiments, I give examples in this small book. So this book should be published by the MIT Press sometime next year. So that's one source of things. And the other things, I think you already know, you know, in the list of publications, I'm not well organized in the sense that, you know, I just moved from my office at MIT and a lot of the things. In fact, you know, I know we even have a book of Wolfgang Gitz's on the mole coupling theory. It used to sit on my shelf and I couldn't move everything. So I'm in bad shape regarding archive matter, printed matter. But there's this book that's coming out next year and it's just called Molecular Mechanisms. It's my attempt to try to put all these journey stops along the way to try to encourage young people to say that this field is really very much alive. We haven't talked about artificial intelligence, machine learning, neural networks, and whatnot. I think the future looks very bright, and all I can say is that, you know, I'm happy to contribute at this point. Probably the only thing I can send you information on this book if you're interested.
Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you.